Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 116, being recorded on the 24th of February, 2016, with special guest Buck Woody. I'm Sujit, and I have Evan and our special guest Buck. Kale's running a little late. He was stuck on a train. He said he might join us in a bit if he can. But we'll get started in the interest of time. And right away, we want to just cover a few updates in the Azure space. And some of them might relate to Buck's area of expertise, which is machine learning and data science, which is a very exciting topic. We haven't really covered it on the show, and really fortunate to have him here to enlighten us on those two areas not necessarily specific to Azure, but I'm sure the cloud makes them a lot better. So Buck, if you find any of the updates that we're going to talk about interesting to you, feel free to chime in.
Will do.
The one that there's a few of them that I put in the show notes. The first one I was very excited about this one, being a developer. It's not really Azure specific, but Scott Guthrie did make the announcement today. So he's the kind of head of Azure, and I think a lot of people have probably caught on to the news that Microsoft has announced that they want to acquire Xamarin, which is the cross-platform app developer toolset maker. So that's very exciting news. It means that now we can, we've always been able to build cross-platform apps on any device using C# and a variant of .NET. And now we'll own the company that does it. So I'm sure that'll help us with our mobile initiative.
That's huge, Sujit. I mean, that's like, we've talked on this show a bunch about, kind of the evolution of us as a company, right, in this new world, and this just yet another nail in the it must be, Windows and it must be .NET coffin, right?
Exactly. It's all open. It's all cross-platform now, from Linux to Xamarin, all over the place. And the other piece of news that, there's a couple of other items I wanted to bring up real quick is, Evan, and I don't know if this has started happening on a broader scale, but it seems now, starting with Azure Automation, they're going to start deprecating some of the functionality in the old portal. It used to be that a lot of the functionality was either in the old or the new or was duplicated, but now they're starting to deprecate stuff in the old, and they say coming sometime in March, Azure Automation, if you try to access in the old portal, you'll get redirected to the new portal. So is that sort of a trend over here? They're starting to move stuff over now?
Well, I don't know. It depends on which old portal we're talking about, right? I mean, like, so...
The current production portal. I don't know.
Yeah,
the
right.
Classic
portal.
Like,
no, but I mean, I've been in this space for, 8 years, 9 years now, and we had the original portal, which I can't even remember how it was implemented. Then we had the Silverlight portal, and then we had the HTML5 portal, and now we have the new current portal, which referred to as Ibiza. Yeah, I mean, this is absolutely the pattern, right? We get to a certain point where the new portal has enough in it to kind of hit critical mass where it's like, okay, we're actually going to start, intentionally moving things and pulling them out of the old portal so that at some point we can turn off the classic portal.
Right. So that's good. I guess that means that they can light up a whole bunch of new functionality, which may be somewhat limiting, in the current portal technology.
Absolutely. I mean, it's also just all about, taking advantage of it's a lot richer, environment and not having, I do a little bit with Azure Backup myself, just kind of personally, and mm-hmm. It's so jarring when you click on it, goes, oh, hey, I'm launching the other portal, and now I have to remember where everything is.
Mm.
Yeah, so, no, it's a good thing.
Good. And another update that it's in preview form. This is temporal tables in Azure SQL database. Which actually I didn't know this feature even existed in SQL, in the regular SQL product, and I'm glad to see it now in Azure SQL, which is so temporal databases are temporal tables are used when you have to write applications that keep a history of all changes made to a particular record. I suppose for auditing purposes, sometimes you need to know exactly all the changes that happened over time. And normally, I have actually built applications to do this. It's a pain in the neck to actually do it yourself, in the app code. There's a lot of code that you have to write to keep a track of all the changes. And now, apparently, if you use temporal tables, it's all automatic in SQL Server. So, a nice feature that is being enabled in Azure SQL Database and is currently in preview form. So, let's see. Next up is, well, there's a couple of other, I suppose, relatively minor updates. There's some updates to the Logic Apps, which is the designer has now been improved. And there's also an update, a preview for HD Insight tools for IntelliJ. And this is, I mean, I don't know. And Buck, have you used HD Insights or IntelliJ? The whole
Oh yeah.
Storm, Spark, sorry, the Spark system.
Yeah, the HDI, the Hortonworks implementation of Hadoop on Azure and on premises, actually. I've used both and actually used it pretty early. I go pretty far back with Azure, and so was part of the original class that they had taught. And it's ironic because next week I'll be teaching a data science course to some folks in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And Horton HDI is part of that, HD Insight.
That's great. And this whole thing with IntelliJ, the tools for IntelliJ, are you familiar with that tool set with regard to Spark applications?
No, haven't been using the IntelliJ stuff yet. That's new to me.
Okay. So that's so I didn't know about that myself. I just know that they came up with an update on that for, and I guess it really applies to folks that use Spark with HD Insight, and so that support is now in Azure. Well, so I think that kind of rounds up all updates. So Buck, it's a good segue that you started talking about some of your background. Would you mind giving our listeners a quick, refresher on what you've been doing at Microsoft and how you came about being this expert in data science and machine learning?
Ooh, I get worried about the term expert. Yeah, my name is Buck Woody. For those of you that don't know me, I've been in technology for, well, over 30 years. I'm kind of old. And about 10 years ago, I came to Microsoft thinking I was going to stay about 4 years and then move on. And here we are 10 years later. But I've been at several roles there at Microsoft. I've always kind of been in data in some format or another, sometimes security and so on, but always data. And when I first started at Microsoft, I was on the product team, the engineering team, for SQL Server, and was a PM, a program manager. They call those here at Microsoft. Not a project manager, a little different. But at any rate, we shipped SQL Server 2008, and that was my product, and really enjoyed being on the. Had never been in a world level, software organization before. I'd been in lots of software organizations. But never at the level that Microsoft's at. Learned a great deal. Went out in the field for SQL Server for a while. Lived up there near Seattle, and basically my territory was sort of the Pacific Northwest, and did quite a bit there. I'm intimately associated and friendly with the folks over at the PASS, Professional Association for SQL Server. And did things with our larger clients, what we call our enterprise group. And enjoyed that a great deal. And then this new thing called Red Dog came out. And when I heard what it was, that it was our cloud, I said, man, I got to get on that. So I applied for and was one of the first technical specialists on the Azure platform. At the time, all it did was platform as a service. You could write some .NET type code and it would run it. And it was pretty limited. It was great platform, but I knew it was where we needed to go. So I jumped on that, did that in what we call incubation, which is where we put new products. And as the platform got more and more mature, and this is back in, oh gosh, 2009, I guess, is when I joined the Azure team. And as it got more and more mature, I actually joined the headquarters and became one of the worldwide TSPs for Azure. That's the folks that there's about three of them in the world that sort of oversee the various districts and so on from the technical perspective, and really enjoyed that, and then got ready to move back home to Florida, which is where I live now, and took a Department of Defense gig with Microsoft as an architect, doing stuff with things for people, and did that for about a year. And then when this position came open on the machine learning and data science team, man, I jumped on that. It was another place that I really, really enjoy being. So that's where I'm at now. Right now, our team's role, I'm part of the team that was acquired, the Revolution Analytics. I don't know if you guys, what's now become the Microsoft R server.
Mm-hmm.
We purchased a company called Revolution Analytics, and that team came over, and I joined them. And so I'm around a bunch of very, very intelligent PhD-type smart people, and I get to play with some really, really fun technology. And at the moment, we're educating internally and externally folks on data science using the Microsoft platform, specifically what we call Cortana Analytics.
Yeah.
Have you guys had a chance to play with Cortana Analytics at all?
Yeah,
I have not. I don't know if Sajid has toyed around with it some.
I played with it when I was, I mean, I met Buck over in Seattle when we were there for Tech Ready, and there were some sessions over there that I played around. It's very, very, and one of my favorite services now. I've been doing some work with it as soon as I got back. So definitely something
I
recommend
it's
everybody
a,
looks at.
It's more of a platform than it is, you know, a particular product, and that's where the sometimes even the confusion can come in, that people are like, okay, what product is this? And it's actually not a product. It's a group of products. And you put those together in kind of a stack to solve various problems. I've got a little blog site going. It's just buckwoody.wordpress.com. But if you search for Buck Woody on the web, you'll hit me as one of the first or second hits there. And just hit up that blog, and I've got some stuff around sort of moving from the data professional world into this new data science world. And at first, I kind of thought it was a hype train kind of thing, but in fact, it's real. It's there is a real, data science is a real thing. It's not just a made-up marketing term.
So Buck, you know, I mean, I've been trying to figure out since I got back from Seattle a couple of weeks ago, is, you know, when did this, like, did this whole rise in data science and machine learning, which, you know, nowadays seems like everybody's talking about it, is why did this suddenly happen? You know, at least it seems to me it happened over the last year or so, you know, in the last few months. And if that's true, is this new technology, or is it just old technology and people are figuring out, oh, this is useful for a lot of cool things? Like, how did this suddenly become so prevalent in our industry?
Yeah, where did it come out of, right? And again, when I first heard it, I thought, well, this must be some data science. What does that even mean? You know, because we've heard, you know, you're a DBA, a database administrator, and then you're a database developer maybe, or maybe you're a database architect, I've heard, and a BI specialist and a business analyst and all these other terms that I was very familiar with having been in this area of technology for so long. And then I'm like you, I heard this data science thing. I'm like, what is this?
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of started looking around at it. And in fact, it is older than it sounds. Things always appear to be to spring up all of a sudden when they reach sort of a tipping point. But in fact, it's been around for quite a while. And one might say that it's been evolving this way for a long time anyway. In other words, it's had other names. Folks like at Boeing or when I worked at NASA for a while, we had folks that were researchers, they would be called. And then, of course, you've always had statisticians that have worked in places. And then you've always had data professionals. And if you think about it, a data scientist is a person who perhaps she's had a background in statistics and she knows programming and she also knows the domain knowledge of businesses and organizations. Sometimes that segments off into science or technology or business or Wall Street or whatever. But it's this perfect storm of those technologies. And the difference, the reason we're hearing this now is because computing has you guys have probably seen the pendulum swing back to this decentralized computing again, right? We had the centralized mainframe, and then it broke apart into PCs, and everybody did things. And then the minute you do that, you're like, well, now they don't talk. So we created networks and put them back together. And then you had servers, and pretty much everything's done on the server, and all you need is a little notebook to do everything you need to do. And now suddenly it's broken apart again to where you can split up the processing load. We've got new technologies, and the bandwidth is better, at least within the data centers. And so now we can truly distribute computing. And when that happened, these same techniques that we've been able to do well since statistics now are more reachable in these mind-numbing sizes that would be impossible to calculate any other way. So that's sort of the predictive side, if you think about that. And then there's the classification side where we get into machine learning, where I'd like to do things like computer vision or handwriting recognition or voice recognition or some really big problems, computing sight and so on. And when we get to those, the data sizes and the inputs, and more importantly, the variables within that amount of inputs become outrageous to do by hand. But with these new paradigms of being able to split the load out, you now have this wonderful new tipping point where I have the computing power to compute the things that I now have the algorithms for. In machine learning, I'm actually able to put things together and have the computer either guess what's going to happen or guess which part of a group a thing might be. And it learns using various algorithms, just like we do. You look at something, you look at a stove, and you see there's a red on, light on the stove, and you see something boiling, and you immediately associate that with hot. But you didn't always know that. You learned by experimentation that touching something like that was a bad idea because it was hot. And the computers do exactly the same thing. With the data, they can wander across a data set and say, okay, I think it's this. And you hold out a little bit of that data with the answers, and you tell the computer, that's right. You got it right. And it strengthens that particular learning capability in one mode. Or perhaps you tell it, nope, you're wrong. And it says, okay, why was I wrong? And it starts figuring these things out. And it's really kind of magical to see it crunch through all these kinds of data and say, okay, I think I understand how to do this now. Now you can feed me something unknown and I can figure it out. So we go from it not knowing what to do to training it to know what to do.
Yeah, I saw a really interesting demo about that. And just, a little bit for folks kind of in the field, like what we do with our data and support, right? We're always trying to look at patterns and trends and, in what bucket is this bug or this, customer scenario, and so that we can, like go invest in fixing that so customers don't have to call us, right? And
Right.
it's always has been like, it has been awful to try and, create a tree of these are the root causes we think it might be, and then, try and match that against real stuff. And then, oh, by the way, since a human being has to code it, you have to hope they code it right, and, all that kind of stuff. And I saw a demonstration recently of somebody that's trying to apply some of this machine learning to say, hey guys, you don't have to root cause your stuff anymore. You can just feed it all the results, all the troubleshooting that we did and the answers and everything, and then the machine learning is what they're trying to teach it to be smart enough to say, hey, this is the bucket that this case should be in that'll tell us, and then we look at how many cases are in that bucket, and then we know where to go invest without having to, train the people, come up with the root cause tree, and all, because all that stuff is fraught with error.
That's
And it
cool.
was
That's right.
really amazing to see that because that's just such a pain to do by hand.
So
So the potential is awesome.
is that an example of classification that you just talked about, Buck?
Yeah, it's similar to that. And it's kind of interesting too because a data scientist is someone who at one point tries to convince you that the computer can come up with the right answer and also tries to convince you not to get too excited about that because it could be wrong. So the statistician in them says,
Lowering expectations, are we, Buck?
yeah, you gotta say, well, yeah. I mean, if you think about things, there are various thresholds, aren't they? So if I'm going to buy something, and it costs $1 and I might like it and I might not, then 50-50 odds are okay. But if it could kill me or it can't, then 50-50 becomes less interesting to me, and I want a slightly higher confidence level in what I'm doing. And so the two things I think that separate out sort of data science from traditional sort of data mining or business intelligence, which, by the way, haven't gone anywhere. Those things are still completely viable, completely usable, and used in a different way. If I need to explore data, I don't use a data science algorithm to do that. I actually would use something like data mining instead, which has some data science algorithms in it, to be honest. But the point is that if I'm exploring data, I might do one thing. And if I'm looking for an answer, and that's where data science, I think, comes into its own, it's less about show me the list of customers that are, you know, that are in Nevada, and it's more along the lines of, you know, I've got a bunch of aluminum outside. Should I make an airplane wing or hubcaps to make the best profit? It's that sort of dependencies. And then the breadth of data sources that a data science project might use would be a lot different than something that you might use internally for a business intelligence project.
So that gets into more of the HD Insight world, where you're dealing with a lot of unstructured data. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, then you get into the whole tool set. And so one of the dangerous things within any kind of technology solution-based environment is going straight to the tech when you hear a problem. So you've seen this too. You've seen people that, as somebody's describing a problem, they're sort of doing a B-tree index in their head. You know, somebody says, well, we want to look for this, and they go, okay, you want this. And we're looking for that, and they're basically just sort of trimming out the various technologies, and then they come to the one they know, and they go, you need a relational database, because that's what they're familiar with. And that may be the right answer, but it may also not be. So in data science, it's more around, what are you really trying to find out? For instance, I might say to you, where could I find the weather report for Tampa, Florida today? And you would say, well, I mean, you could use the internet, or you could watch TV, or you could listen to the radio. Ooh, I've got this cool PowerShell script that would do it for you, and so on. But a data scientist would stop and go, well, why do you want to know that? And you'd say, oh, I'm just looking for whether it will rain or not. And then immediately the person goes, oh, okay, well, if you want to know whether it rains or not, you can do this predictive model or that predictive model. And the data scientist say, wait a minute, why do you care if it rains or not? And the person says, well, I need to know if I need to take my umbrella with me. And so the real question is, do you need an umbrella? Hmm. And that is where you won't jump to a technology. So now returning to your question, inside HD Insight is within Cortana Analytics. So Cortana Analytics is a series of about 11 products, and you can learn more about them just by going to CortanaAnalytics.com. But it's a suite of them. But then the HD Insight is built on Hadoop, or is Hadoop, and Hadoop is yet another platform with lots of things in it, like Spark that you mentioned, and a few other technologies, Mahout for machine learning, and so on. So you could live just within one product to get the answer. But instead, what we normally do when we're tearing apart a data science problem is we ask, you know, what are you trying to find out? Well, I really want to know, do I need to get an umbrella? And you even push back on that and say, do you need to know what kind of umbrella, or do you need to know when you'll need the umbrella, and so on. Once that's done, you pick the data sources, then you pick the algorithms that might answer that question, the basket of things that you would do. Then you go to the tech. You go to, this is why Cortana Analytics is sort of a stack. You go to that and say, what does this well? So as you're talking, if we tear apart our problem, you want to know, and in fact, I did an interesting blog post this morning on that exact topic, where a fictitional, I'm using air quotes here, a fictitional store that sells subscriptions to a fitness program that is tied to a fitness device that you wear, was offering like a discount to a gymnasium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they said, is this thing paying off or not? And when they looked, a straight analysis, a straight reporting query type analysis showed that it was costing more to give people the gym membership discount than we were making in profit. And so the response was, we should ditch that program because, you know, it has this issue that we're not making money on it. But we said, wait a minute, let's take into account more variables. And when we did, we found out that that same company also has a clothing line. And it turned out that we ended up finding through basket analysis the fact that people that bought the gym membership or used the gym membership were also buying more clothing. And the clothing markup was such that it more than covered what the gym membership was costing the company. So in fact, instead of reducing or eliminating that benefit, they enlarged it. And they contacted the gyms and said, would you mind if we put some samples of our clothing in the gymnasiums for when people walk in? And so instead of it becoming a something they got rid of, it became a new revenue opportunity. And that's the kind of process. Now, to get there, we used R, we did use HDI and a few other things because they had a large data set. Large data sets lend themselves well to HD Insight. And so on. I think you get the idea.
I
that
do, yes.
It's rather than a basket of technologies, it's more a process.
Process. And I'm glad you mentioned one of those scenarios, because my next question to you is going to be, can you, you know, name a few scenarios that you've seen in the field? You did mention one of them. Is there anything, any other one that jumps up at you?
Oh, sure. The big one right now, and you know, the funny thing is a lot of these things are quite mundane. They don't sound exciting. You know, you can think about HoloLens, and you can think about the new cognitive computing stuff from like IBM's Watson and some of the cool things that Google is doing and some of the amazing things that we're doing here at Microsoft. And those are very sexy and out in front and all that sort of thing. But a lot of these things are quite mundane, but necessary. In California, for instance, many of the farmers have outfitted their fields with sensors for moisture. And these are very, very, very tiny little computers. They're called a stamp. They're very tiny, but they send moisture telemetry back. And so the field is only watered to exactly the amount that that portion of the field needs. And that's all done through, you know, stream analytics, which is part of the Cortana Analytics suite of products, and the proper query that says, when I reach this threshold for this period of time based on these conditions and the evaporation and the weather report and all of these other multivariate things that we're looking at, the farmers end up not just saving water because they don't have any. The counties have cut off the amounts of water they had. So this is not a matter of just being a good citizen. This is survival. So that's another one. Smart power grids come to mind as well. The little wearable fitness bands that you're thinking about from the last example, that's another one that IoT. So IoT is a very fast-growing, albeit boring, place that you'll see data science, you know, used.
So that's a good point. So if you take a typical IoT scenario, how does machine learning fit into that equation?
So inside IoT, the difference now is that we're getting a data storm from everything. And the more variables you have, let's put it this way. You've got, you and I are driving in the car. So you say, would you like something to eat? And I say, sure. And you say, what would you like to eat? And I say, well, I like all kinds of foods. I like Mexican foods, and I like Italian foods, and I like Indian foods. And you go, oh, I know a great Indian place. It's South Indian. Do you like South Indian food? Because that's hotter. Do you like sambar and idli dosa and all these? And I say, yeah, that sounds amazing. Let's go do that. So that's one variable. Buck Woody's in the car with you, and you're trying to figure out where to eat. But now let's bring our co-host in, and let's bring your wife in, and your cousin, and then your kids. And then you say, where would everybody like to eat? Now, what do you think the odds of coming up with a place we can all eat are?
Slim.
Right? We're definitely going to the food court at the mall now, so everybody can just get what they want, right?
Right.
So there's so many variables, and that's a silly example, but the point is, the more of these variables you add in, the harder it is to make a true prediction. Coffee will give you cancer, but another study shows that coffee will prevent cancer. And so what do you do with all this information? Well, within data science, you have the ability to find out which things are the most predictive. In other words, I can throw down several hundred variables. I can tell Azure ML, which is our machine learning tool, all online. I can use it from a Mac or Linux or whatever I've got. and I hit that, and I can actually tell it to look at the data and then a label, in other words, what I want to know. And I can say which of these things is the most predictive. And it will come down and say, you know, it turns out these five things are the only things you really need to care about. These other things are factors, but they're not big factors. What really matters is this. The Pima Indian tribe up there in Washington state has a predisposition to diabetes. And it's a genetic trait. And so it creates within it an environment where we can do lots of testing because diabetes is still fairly rare. I mean, it's common, but it's fairly rare to get diabetes. And so whenever you have tons and tons of variables like weight and age and height and sex and grandparents and did you smoke and all these other things, the more of these variables we get on people that don't get diabetes, the less we can check to see what affects diabetes. But if you have a tribe of people that gets diabetes rather frequently, now you've got a perfect environment. And so we did exactly that, took a look at the Pima Indian tribe, and we asked all the different things that had been measured, the blood tests and all these medical things around the Pima Indian tribe members. And we said, tell us which of these things will predict the most whether someone within this set will get the disease or not, diabetes or not. And it came back with these five indicators were the biggest, like weight and age, and did a relative have it as well, and so on. Mm-hmm. This allows doctors now to focus on the things that matter rather than perhaps the fact that you have blue eyes does not mean you're going to get diabetes. Has nothing to do with it. So in that case, now we can stop having doctors check people with blue eyes and look for those traits. We can tell people you need to lose weight. You need, as you get older, to be checked more often and to watch your diet and so on, if those are the causal effects. Data science, the algorithms, can actually tell you which of those features, they're called, are the most predictive to the label, the answer you want.
Mm. Got it.
That's not so. So I think, Buck, when I hear you talk about all this, really what it comes down to is what you're providing or what your kind of role is at this point is. It's kind of ironic, but adding the intelligence to the business stuff, right? So that you know what the right thing to do, so that you can then make the right decision. Like you're first picking the tool before you even come up with the solution. But on top of
that,
you're
right,
really trying to make the business intelligence so that you don't have to understand all the ins and outs and all that, and you still arrive at this really intelligent decision in the end without having to know
right
necessarily how everything all relates, like traditional engineering, right? You have to know how it relates before you can design the algorithm. This
exactly.
Kind of
now,
the
someone
way.
Does. You know, down at the bottom, someone knows how these things work. You have to trust that these algorithms were written
right
correctly. And they're the right ones to use at the right time. But once that intelligence is baked in, and we have a couple of things inside Azure ML that makes that compelling. The first is that the algorithms we have, which are already there, you just pull them down and use them. There's lots, and you have to know which ones to use when, but they are the best algorithms around. Microsoft Research over in Cambridge, England, and in other places came up with these, and they're widely recognized as being very authoritative algorithms. So you don't have to come up with the math. It's there. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is that the environment that Azure ML provides allows the data scientists to work together regardless of where they are, which is also new. It used to be that you'd get your R or your Mahout, and you'd send that around to everybody, and you'd all try it individually, whereas the experiments that you design inside Azure ML are on a palette that people can use, just like you can use OneNote real time. You can do the same thing inside. You can invite people to your experiment. Once you've verified that you like this particular algorithm set, you can click a publish button. When you do that, all of the experiment parts get stripped away, and it turns into essentially a function. And from Excel or code or a REST interface or a phone or anything, you can now call that trained model and say, do I need to get my umbrella out? Mm-hmm. And from your code, you no longer have to care how that's happening once you trust it. It will come back and say within a 90% probability you do. And so now developers are freed to use these things that are highly predictive. And again, we're talking about everything from diabetes tests to, I mean, imagine that a doctor in a far-off country with just a cell phone and a light sensor could shine light through the back of someone's hand, read the refraction from the blood cells, and get a prediction as to whether they need to send that person on for more treatment or not in just a few seconds. I mean, that's Star Trek kind of stuff, and it's
Yeah,
very exciting.
that's just amazing. Yeah, I mean, but I mean, and you know, really, I thought I got excited about this after coming back from Tech Ready, but you really shed a lot of light on this in terms of some of the inner workings and why this is so become so important. Because that thing was bothering me. Why did this thing suddenly become so important and so
Yeah.
prevalent in our space over here? And you've really made that very clear. I appreciate your insight into this, Buck. And it's great that you
Absolutely.
have
And you know,
people like you. Yeah, go ahead.
one more point on that. What, you know, have you ever noticed that suddenly a band will become just overly popular,
Yeah.
and you start following that band of music, and you're like, wow, these guys are really good. And then, like 2 years later, they stop touring, they stop performing, and when they interview them on the TV show, why did you guys stop performing? Well, we've just been doing this for so long, and now we've got kids, and we're doing. And you're like, doing this so long, and you find out that they've actually been touring for like 20 years, and
Right.
it's very similar. But you only heard about them last week, and it's very similar to data science. I mean, it's been around. You know, research and statistics and programming and big data have been around for quite a while. It's just all come together now, and there's been some fairly high-profile things that have hit that have brought it very mainstream, and it's an exciting, exciting field.
Right. And of course, it does help that it's all so easily available in the Azure ML Studio. I would say democratized it in a way that anybody can approach it. You know, you don't have to be a data scientist if you want to try it out. I went through some of the tutorials. It's so easy, you know, like a Visio like Canvas that they give you to work on, as you mentioned earlier. It's
And I
just.
think the other piece to that is that not only are we kind of making the, for lack of a better word, design time experience easier, but the whole provisioning of the components underneath it, right? It used to take significant knowledge just to do
Right.
that. Now it's like, hey, I want a
Oh yeah.
cluster done,
Yeah,
right?
just
And that's
that's
a
right.
big
That's right.
enabler, I think, as well.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, as I was designing my labs for my teaching next week, I also teach at the University of Washington. I contrasted that with having to set up a Hadoop cluster manually. You know, I did it with scripts and so on, but still standing up all the boxes and running all the scripts and so on. Now, within an Azure Data Factory framework, which is our orchestration piece, sort of our scheduler, if you will, I merely select a task called on-demand HD Insight cluster, and it says, how big do you want it? And I tell it how big I'd like it, and then it literally, as part of bringing in the data and getting it ready to be looked at by an Azure ML experiment, it stands up the cluster, crunches the data, spits out the result, shuts the cluster down as part of a chain. I don't do any of that.
Hey, Buck, just for comparison,
That's
like if
amazing.
you, so you, it sounds like you probably have the knowledge to stand up a HD Insight or Hadoop cluster on your own. How long would that take? You know, you, somebody that knows what you're doing, how long would it take you to do that?
Oh, it all depends. It's a little bit of a loaded question. If I had a, you know, a Linux box or a Windows box, and I'm going to stand up a cluster from zero, installing all the
Yeah.
software, it's not too bad. An hour or two, probably. Maybe 30 minutes, depending on how quickly I can download the source. But
Right.
it's not hard at all to stand up one Hadoop cluster. It is really hard to start connecting it to thousands of nodes. That becomes
Yeah,
an
but
N wave problem.
I think that's kind of what I was going to is like you know what you're doing, and even you are saying minimum of 30 minutes to an hour plus, you know, additional stuff on top of that for all the processing nodes,
Oh,
and
yeah.
now you just picked an operation in the
I
data
just pick it.
factory.
That's right. That's exactly right. No, and it is incredible. And if you guys, by the way, and your listeners, you know, this will be after tonight, but tonight premiering on PBS, Public Broadcasting, there's a here in the U.S., and you can go to PBS.org and find this probably after the fact. They usually show these. There's a program they're doing called the Human Face of Big Data, The Human Face of Big Data, and it talks about the extraordinarily huge and frequent amounts of data that have come in. I've got some statistics that are just absolutely stunning. One of them is that about, this is rough here, about 90% of the data stored today has been collected in the last 5 years. Let me make sure that you understand what I'm saying. All the data we stored since the beginning of history, like all the way back to where we started writing, all of that, 90% of what is recorded now from eternity past that we know about to now, 90% of that has been generated in the last 5 years.
Yep. And I can
Wow.
take a gander. Just 10% is Twitter, 20% is probably Facebook, and 30% is
Well, actually,
Instagram, right? I'm just kidding.
And the IoT, the Internet of Things, just keeps piling it in. If you ever want to be amazed at the amount of data you generate, what we call data exhaust, just open your phone or do a quick search on the web and type in what is my phone telemetry sending back and when. And if you have maps and your GPS enabled, if you have the weather enabled, if you have Twitter and Facebook enabled, you are generating, several thousand bytes a minute of data all on your own by having your phone turned on. That's not counting anything else you've got going in your house or your computer, much less your computer. I mean, when you think about what we're generating, and most of that is untapped. We're
That's
not even
amazing.
starting to measure or look at it yet. We just haven't had time to come around to it.
Yeah. Now, so Buck, I would appreciate if you could, if you have any special links that you would like to share with our listeners, so they can get started on this stuff easily. I know I was very excited to go to some of the tutorials. But if you have anything special, your blog, etc., please send that over to me. I'll put that in the show notes so our listeners will have that as a handy
Perfect,
reference.
yeah.
All right.
That sounds great. No, I'd be glad to do that.
And thank you again very much for taking this time to enlighten us and our
Absolutely.
listeners on this extremely important topic. Appreciate that, Buck.
I appreciate you having me on.
All right. Evan,
Yeah, thanks again, Buck.
good to have you as
Oh,
well.
no worries. Thanks, guys. Have a great evening and go make some data.
Will do. Thanks. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.